Just hold on to the promises. Hold on to the promises. Jesus is alive, so hold tight. Hold on to the promises.
Holding on to those promises this morning as we start off a brand new work week. The promise that Jesus Christ is Lord and that you can have a relationship with Him simply by confessing your sins, turning to Him. And all of that stuff, all that junk from your past is gone. That is the amazing thing about a relationship with Christ. It's 35 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer. Joining us this morning is Dr. David Aikman. David is an award-winning print and broadcast journalist, a best-selling author, and a foreign affairs commentator. He also is a history professor at Patrick Henry College in Virginia. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure, and the Supreme Court has lost one of its brightest stars over the weekend with the death of Antonin Scalia. What can you tell us about Justice Scalia's impact on the court over the years that he served?
Well, Scalia was one of the most articulate and forceful interpreters of the Constitution in a way that focused on the original meaning of the text. And therefore, he was a real structuralist in terms of not wanting people, not wanting the judiciary to perform the function of changing the meaning of the Constitution to accord with popular feelings about various issues. So he was a staunch conservative. He was a dedicated opponent of abortion, and he opposed Roe versus Wade all the way through. In fact, he very nearly succeeded in persuading his fellow justices to overthrow it at one point. But he was a great protector of the Second Amendment's rights, and he was a great opponent of federalist attempts to control the rights of the states. So all in all, he was a unique defender of the conservative principles of freedom and autonomy from a central government. He was an extraordinary man.
Now, in addition to being a brilliant jurist, he was also a man very full of life who had a great sense of humor. Did you ever have an opportunity to meet him or hear him speak?
You know, unfortunately, I regret that I never had an opportunity to hear him speak. I may have shaken his hand at some function many years ago in D.C., but I heard from everybody who had met him that he was a very jovial, congenial, warm person with a wicked sense of humor. And, of course, the remarkable thing about Scalia was that he was able to make firm friends with people whose views he didn't share at all, particularly his fellow Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a very close friend with her husband of Scalia and his wife. So he never got personal about the issues he felt strongly about, but he was a very, very complete human being in every sense of the word.
I heard a wonderful story Ruth Bader Ginsburg shared, and you mentioned, you know, certainly philosophically, politically, complete opposite ends of the spectrum as to how they interpret the U.S. Constitution. But this was a fun story. After the court's ruling on same-sex marriage, which, of course, Scalia, you know, just was very concerned about, he was in an outing with some other court members, and he actually he got up on stage, and he sang Bob Dylan's song, The Times They Are A-Changin'. Ruth Ginsburg said he did a great job singing. So that's the sort of man he was. You know,
yeah, that's great.
Great example for all of us of someone who holds on to truth and does not waver from their convictions, but also does it in a winsome way. And as you said, made friends with the liberals on the court.
And then doesn't take himself too seriously either. That's a great asset.
Exactly.
Take your principles seriously, but not yourself.
Something every one of us can learn from, certainly. Now, Scalia was what is called an originalist. Dr. Aikman. Can you explain how that shaped his opinions in his Supreme Court decisions?
Well, it meant he was a follower of the intent of the writers of the Constitution, who really had very specific intentions in their formulating the laws of the country, and who were not swayed by fashion or social tendencies that were going on around them. So the original intent principle is a very important principle of conservative jurisprudence. What it means is you don't say, well, nowadays people mean such and such when they use that word. You say no, that you have to go back to the original meaning of the law and look at what the original writers intended. And that is the principle of preserving the principles of the Constitution to protect all of us. I mean, if you start being swayed by fashion and gossip and preference, you'll soon sweep away the whole framework of the structure of our freedom, which is a very dangerous thing to happen.
And, of course, that has happened in many of the recent Supreme Court decisions, things that I personally believe would cause our founders to roll over in their graves. I can't imagine the framers of the Constitution ever envisioning a day when their words would be used to justify changing the entire definition of marriage. I mean, the idea,
of course,
that, you know, the Thomas Jefferson and George Washington could have walked down the aisle together. I mean, it's ludicrous.
It really is ludicrous, and I think it's extremely dangerous. And not only same-sex marriage, but of course Second Amendment rights. I mean, one of the things that Obama is absolutely intent upon is closing sort of loopholes against people owning guns who shouldn't own guns. But in fact, the likelihood is that the kind of restrictions he wants to impose, and he would if the Supreme Court were on his side, would make it much harder for legitimate gun owners to have weapons of self-defense in their possession. It's a very frightening prospect.
One of the brilliant conservative voices on the Supreme Court has passed away. If you did not hear, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia passed away suddenly over the weekend. They believe it was from natural causes. He was 79 years old. Just really sad to see such a brilliant and funny guy, wonderful man with a great sense of humor, loved to do karaoke. You read some of his dissents when the court made some very bad decisions over the past few years, and just, man, put it to him. Talk about solid reasoning and oftentimes very scathing dissents, but on some very important issues. Our guest is Dr. David Aikman. He teaches history at Patrick Henry College in Virginia. And the question now, of course, is who will take Justice Scalia's place? President Obama says he will move forward with nominating his successor. What's the precedent for that in a president in his final year of office? And what's likely to happen, David, when or if his nominee goes before the Republican-controlled Senate?
Well, as Senator Ted Cruz pointed out, there hasn't been a precedent for about 80 years for a president nominating a Supreme Court justice in his final year. Nevertheless, according to the Constitution, the president is required to nominate someone for a Supreme Court position, and the Senate is required to vote to approve or disapprove of it. Obama has made it quite clear that he intends to fill Scalia's position as soon as he can, and the Republicans have made it very clear that they are not going to tolerate and vote for an appointee who was a liberal and would thus distinctly change the whole philosophical structure of the Supreme Court. And the most recent development is that Senator Cruz has said that he personally will lead a strong campaign in the Senate, including filibustering and so forth, to prevent any Obama nominee who has not been agreed upon by the Republicans to be nominated. So it really is, showdown at OK Corral. I mean, I think this is one of the most striking developments in a very striking political year for us.
Now, what happens, and I don't know what the technicalities are of this, perhaps you know, if Obama does nominate someone to replace Scalia and that nominee is not confirmed by the time Obama leaves office next January when the new president is sworn in, what happens to that nomination at that point?
Well, the nomination falls into complete disuse because it is not supported by, in the event that a Republican wins the election in November, he would certainly not sign off on a Supreme Court justice proposed by his liberal predecessor. So what happens if
there's a Democrat, though, that it's elected? Let's say Hillary Clinton is elected president and that nomination is still in play. Would it continue or would Hillary have to nominate someone entirely new?
No, I think, in the event that she were elected, heaven forbid, I say, but in the event that she were or some other Democrat, they might continue with the Obama nominee, or they might reach out to the Republicans and suggest a figure of less controversially dogmatic liberal persuasion. I mean, ideally, in a perfect world, Obama would say, well, look, I can see that politics is really against me. The Republicans control the Senate. They don't want to see the philosophical balance of the Supreme Court change. So therefore, I should nominate somebody who is acceptable to the conservatives in the Senate. Well, Obama obviously has no intentions of doing that, and it's doubtful whether any Democratic successor to him, should such a person be elected, would have the same idea. So I think we're stuck with the possibility of a complete closure of the Senate operations, which Cruz has suggested he might try to do until, if possible, a Republican president is elected.
Well, if you think about the current makeup of the court, which is pretty much evenly divided, Justice Kennedy being the swing vote on many critical decisions and oftentimes, in my opinion, is voted the wrong way, certainly on the same-sex marriage issue. But if we had another liberal on the court, all bets are off as to the viability of the Constitution as our founders intended it. And that is very scary.
Yes, it is. I mean, this is the very thing the framers of the Constitution did not want to see happen. They did not want to see the Supreme Court act in a political function of deciding important political and social issues one way or another by interpreting the Constitution in various ways. So this is something the American founders really feared might happen at some point in the future. Mm. Prayed fervently, those who did pray, that it wouldn't happen.
Now, David, let's switch gears for a moment and talk world affairs. Last week, the U.S., Russia, and other powers agreed to a, quote, cessation of hostilities in Syria.
Right.
Secretary of State John Kerry, very enthusiastic about this agreement, but really, is it likely to mean anything?
No, it's not, unfortunately. And even Secretary Kerry, in his final comments at the news conference, poured the cold water of doubt on anything successfully happening. I mean, the real thing is the situation on the ground is moving inexorably in favor of the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad, whose regime is being successfully propped up by Russian Arab bombing exercises against rebels opposed to Assad in their five-year civil war. And, of course, Assad is also being propped up by Shia militia who've come in from Lebanon, from Hezbollah, and by Syrian money and Syrian strategic advice, Iranian strategic advice. So there is a constellation of forces propping up Assad, and that is leading to a very dangerous situation, especially in regard to Turkey. There is now a serious danger that Turkey might intervene directly in the Syrian civil war and might at any point come into conflict with the Russians, who are trying to help Assad reestablish his regime. And if, for example, Turkish aircraft shot down any Russian aircraft in the future, that could lead to all-out hostilities between Russia and Turkey. And Turkey might invoke Article 5 of the NATO agreement, which says an attack upon one NATO country is tantamount to an attack on the whole alliance. And that might pull us all into a very dangerous war situation in the Middle East.
That is quite frightening when you point that out, David. Turkey, of course, being a NATO ally of the U.S., our relationship with Turkey has been somewhat tenuous at times, but that particular article in the NATO agreement would indeed force us to then take on Putin. And, boy, very frightening. Now, they've had, I think, over 2 million refugees flooding into Turkey, a significant issue for that country. Refugees, of course, in Europe as well. David, are there a significant number of Christians among those refugees?
I think we have to assume so, because Christians have been the target of the depredations of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And there are significant numbers of Christians who have fled to Turkey. And here's another situation. Turkey has absorbed far more refugees from Syria and the Middle East than Europe has already accepted. And Europeans are complaining that they're being overwhelmed by the flood of refugees, not just from Syria and Iraq, but even from as far away as Afghanistan. But the Turks really have a gun to the EU leader's head. Because if they want, they could open their own borders and allow flocks of refugees still currently in Turkey to go over into Europe. And that would be very, very troublesome for the Europeans. Mm.
Dr. David Aikman, thank you so much for your time today, for your expertise, your great wisdom. And I pray the Lord continues to bless you in your work there at Patrick Henry College in Virginia.
Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate being on the program.
56 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network.